Hello and welcome back to Horror from the High Desert. I am your host, Scotty Milder, and this week I have on guest Larry Hinkle. So Larry Hinkle is the least famous writer you've never heard of. A copywriter living with his wife and two doggos in Rockville, Maryland, when he's not writing stories that scare people into peeing their pants, he writes ads that scare people into buying adult diapers so that they're not caught peeing their pants. His debut collection, The Space Between, was published in February of this year from Trepidatio Publishing. His work has also appeared on the No Sleep podcast, Deep Magic, Dark Recesses Press, and Another Dimension Anthology, winner of the 2017 Serling Award from the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation, among others. He's an active member of the HWA. His short stories made the preliminary Stoker ballot in 2020 and 2022, a graduate of Fright Club and Crystal Lake's Author's Journey program, an HWA mentee, and a survivor of the Borderlands Writers Boot Camp. You can stop by and say hi at writtenbylarry.com. Of course, I want to remind you guys to check out the show Nighttime Logic, which is the series hosted by friend of the pod, Daniel Brom. He's the author of The Night Marchers and Other Strange Tales and The Serpent Shadow from Cemetery Dance. The series focuses on the strange, weird, and wonderful side of dark fiction through readings and discussions with diverse authors from around the world. You can tune in on Daniel's YouTube channel, which is his name, Daniel Brom, or at DanielBrom7838. The next episode will feature author Gwendolyn Keist to celebrate the release of her new book, The Haunting of Velkwood, and to talk about a bunch of their favorite ghost stories across all kinds of media. It's an online-only event and free, so just follow the YouTube link to join them live or come back to watch at any time. The event will be Thursday, March 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please go to whatever streaming platform you're using, give 5 stars, leave a review, go to social media, spread the word, tell your friends, and let's go ahead and dive in with Larry Hinkle. So we met briefly, I guess, at StokerCon. Was it this year? Was it in Pittsburgh?
Yeah,
and I know you're friends with Jeff Strand and Bridget Nelson. I think we met through them.
We were all hanging out together in the lobby talking for a while.
Yeah, in the lobby. In the lobby of that nice ass hotel in Pittsburgh.
that hotel, just the whole setup of that hotel was fantastic.
It was
lobby and the bar was right there, and
it was perfect. I mean, the hotel, I don't, were you at the StokerCon the year before in Denver?
Yeah,
it was a nice hotel, but it was like a little bit weird. It was like kind of sort of cramped, and
it was small and very Byzantine corridors,
right?
You were going, and I left some clothes there. I lost some clothes on that trip somehow. And I didn't notice until like maybe 6 months ago, and that would have been a year and a half. And I was where, because it showed up on my memory on Facebook, that shirt, and I was like, what the hell happened to that shirt? And I realized I wore it at StokerCon, and now it's gone.
Swallowed by the hotel. Yeah.
I called my roommate, and I was the guy I roomed with at the time for StokerCon. And I said, Asher Ellis. And I said, you didn't happen to walk out with a couple of shirts, did you? Like, no. I said, okay. Yeah. I guess they're gone.
I guess they disappeared into the void, I guess. But that place in Pittsburgh was nice.
My room over, I could see out the window and see the stadium across the river where, you know, for the Taylor Swift concert, the fireworks going off, and see the big screens. And
I kind of wish I had just sprung for a room there. This is getting into the weeds of convention logistics, but I was trying to save a couple bucks, so I was like, oh, I'll just stay at a Red Roof Inn way off in Monroeville, and it worked out fine. But every time I had to leave and drive out to my little like dumpy little hotel,
at least you were by the mall, though. I mean, I stopped on the way home and got pictures.
Yeah, and that was cool. I was definitely close to the mall. That was.
Yeah.
I think I was like a 5-minute drive from the mall. So
that was a pilgrimage. I had to do that. I wanted to go. The graveyard from Night of the Living Dead is actually north of town, and I just didn't have time to go see it.
I did that. I had a friend who lived in Pittsburgh. He's since moved away, but he was out there. That must have been 2014, 2015. I went out there for a skiing trip, and I had to go out and check out the graveyard. And of course I went out there, it was like the dead of winter, And that was the way to see the graveyard, even though I think they shot it in the summertime, but yeah. Seeing it in the winter, it felt very Night of the Living Dead. I went out there again this trip, and it was like very like idyllic summertime kind of look, and it was like, okay, didn't quite have the vibe.
Man, just overcast snowy graveyard.
It was very spooky in the wintertime. I did drive by the farm, though. It doesn't look anything like the movie, but It was cool to see it. Yeah.
Do people live in it now, or is it still just abandoned?
I think people live there. I think the farmhouse is gone. Definitely a different house there. And there was a big dually pickup truck sitting out front. And I was like, maybe don't stop and take pictures. Yeah, I have a feeling they probably get sick of all us weirdos coming by and gawking all the time.
Yeah, but that goes with the territory, man. You buy it's like whoever bought the Halloween house, they know,
right? Or the Amityville house, or
yeah.
But yeah, so well, I'm happy to have you on the show, and I loved the book. When did the book come out? It's called The Space Between. It's a collection.
It just came out in February. I think 13th, 14th, somewhere around there. So yeah, just been out a month.
Yeah, very recent. And I will admit, I think I've got like 3 stories left. I'll probably finish them tonight. But they're
probably the 3 best ones.
Yeah, I stopped at Catterwall. So that I've got Catterwall, Welcome to Colerville. And then Lost at Last. Those are the 3 I've got that I haven't gotten to yet. I've read everything.
Colorophobia is a fear of clowns. So that's a clown.
Oh, that'll be a fun one.
And Catterwall is about a killer garden gnome.
Nice.
that one actually, pseudopod is a bucket. I'm sure it's a bucket list for everybody. But I've tried so often. And that one, I got a personal rejection from them, and they said that they were passing on it because there's an interrogation scene where the gnome is in the police room, and they said, we're going to pass on this because the interrogation scene is just ridiculously over the top, but we mean that in the nicest way possible. Like he said, I need to put it on a shirt.
Yeah. Well, I did read the first, I think, 2 paragraphs, and it does have a guy waking up to a dead cat on his
porch.
I was like, okay, well, I'm definitely hooked, so I'm looking forward to. But I have to say, this is probably, I mean, I loved Rebecca Rowland's White Trash and Recycled Nightmares, and that's one of the best. And obviously, I talked to her last year, and of course, I love Bridget Nelson's Bouquet of Viscera, which we also talked to her last year.
Yeah.
And I would put this, The Space Between, right up there. This is absolutely one of the best collections I've read in years.
Oh, jeebers. Wow, man. I'm glad people can't see me because I'm totally blushing now. Thank you. Yeah. That, I mean, with those, put it up with those two. I mean, they both gave me blurbs for this book, you know. Both.
Well, and I was actually texting with Rebecca today about it. And I think her quote was like, Larry can write. I think with like 3 exclamation points. and I mean, it's a really fantastic collection. And I do want to get to some of the specific stories. But before I get there, I always like to just start kind of with people's origin stories. And I read your introduction, and there's some specific things in your introduction that I want to touch on. But before we get there, I just kind of want to talk about, like, just kind of tell us kind of where you're from and what sort of brought you to writing, and specifically brought you to horror. Where was the spark? Where did it happen?
That came from my mom. I'm from Columbus, Ohio, although I left there in 2001. Yeah. Since then, we've lived in Colorado Springs, Denver, San Antonio, Omaha, and now we're in Rockville. We move a lot around from my wife's job.
And Rockville's in Maryland?
Maryland, yeah. It's about 13 miles outside of D.C. proper, but it takes an hour to get there in your car.
Yeah. Funny. I have family connections to almost everywhere you've mentioned, or family or personal connections to almost everywhere you've mentioned. So nice. My dad went to college. My dad's from Cleveland. He went to college in Columbus. I have family in the D.C. area. I've lived in Colorado Springs and Denver. So
I never thought I would like it out here on the East Coast, but I think our house backs up to Rock Creek Park, and I can hop on the trail and ride my bike Down from our house to the National Mall and back is about a 50-mile, 50, 55-mile round trip. So I do that. And that's a fun ride, you know. So it's cool.
Cool.
I don't know if we're going to retire here or not, but you
Yeah.
know, it's good for
Yeah.
now.
Nice.
Eventually, Colorado is the plan. But
Right.
anyway, no, I got into horror because of my mom. She was a big horror fan, and she got me reading, you know, Stephen King, like probably way too early, and got me watching the movies. Every Friday night, we would watch Chiller Theater, and me and my brother would bring our sleeping bags out in the living room and get popcorn and just lay on the floor in the living room and watch scary movies, you know, because they always had a double feature, and that was. I can remember my dad was involved, obviously. It wasn't just mom, but we went to a drive-in when I was really young. It was before my sister was born. So I would have had to been, or she was at a babysitter maybe. So I would have probably had been like 5, 6, 7 years old. And we went, and Night of the Living Dead, it was a Dusk to Dawn horror thing. And Night of the Living Dead was the last movie they showed. And there were people in the drive-in lot dressed as zombies walking around, you know.
Nice.
You know, people's cars just scaring the crap out of me, and it
Nice.
was awesome. And
And
that's
how
what
old would you
kind
have
of
been?
I was probably 6, 7 years old, somewhere
Oh,
around.
so it's
You
the
know, and
perfect age.
oh yeah, it was great. And it's now my favorite movie. It's a every in October I watch. I'll do at least one scary movie a night for the whole month, but then on Halloween night it's three movies, but I always end with Night of the Living Dead. That's just like that's how October racks up.
I would say John Carpenter's The Thing is my favorite movie, but Night of the Living Dead is that's the movie when I was in high school. I discovered it on VHS probably in middle school. So this would have been like 90, 91. And I went to sleep to that movie the way like some people go to sleep to like Pink Floyd. They put on, Dark Side of the Moon and just go to sleep. I went to sleep to Night of the Living Dead almost every night through high school, like for probably 4 years of high school. I would just put it in the VCR and watch it and just drift off. So I've had that movie like on a loop probably thousands of times through my
It's a
head.
comfort watch, you know. And a few years ago, they MoMA did a 4K restoration of it, and we got to go to the college in Omaha and on in theater, and it was so cool. It's so different than seeing on your TV an old ratty VHS copy, you know, because it's been in public domain forever, so anyone could put it on a tape.
Right. I think the first version of it I saw was like this really, probably by today's standards, unwatchable kind of,
Oh man. So that's how I got started. I always wanted to be a writer. And I went to The Ohio State University, which is, you know, the best college in the world,
Yeah,
despite
that's
what
where
my
my
parents
dad
would
went.
tell you. Yeah, well, good man, you know. And I went there because I lived in Columbus and it was cheap and I lived at my parents' house. But I took a creative writing class there, and they did it a lot like how Borderlands used to run, where, you know, you would turn your story in and they would go around the circle critiquing it, and you had to sit there and just take it, and you weren't allowed to defend yourself. And I got beat up so hard, just because everyone there was they were all, you know, literary writers, and here I am, Twilight Zone stuff. And honestly, I got just demoralized so much that I quit writing. I
Yeah,
didn't start again.
this is what I wanted to, you talk about this in your intro, and I wanted to touch on this because this is an experience I somehow avoided for the most part, I would say, through my college writing career. But I've heard so many horror stories from people over the years, particularly genre writers. And it makes me so angry when I hear these stories, particularly from someone like you. Like I said, I read your collection and it's fantastic. I mean, it's one of the best collections I've ever read. I teach writing, I teach screenwriting at a community college, but also at the university level. And I deal with students who come in, who've never been encouraged, who are coming from, family situations sometimes where it's like no one has told them that they could be a writer, they're coming from school systems where, it's like 40 kids to a classroom and they want to do this and they've never been taught, you know, the fundamentals of grammar, but they're talented and they're eager to learn. They're sponges, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and a lot of them, they want to write, you know, they've watched horror movies, they've watched Tarantino movies, or, you know, I mean, that's what they want to write. And like, sometimes these kids, they come from like environments where, like, you know, they've dealt with violence and stuff. And that's, you know, what they're working out in their
process, their
writing. And I remember I'm sorry, I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant. I hope you indulge me because you triggered me. You triggered me with your introduction. A former film professor of mine, I saw on a Facebook post years ago talking about how he wanted to ban the use of weapons in student films. Any short film that used violence, this is probably 2017, 2018, whether it was a fake gun or a knife, and not for safety concerns, not for, you know, like, there is a problem when you're dealing with short films. Like, you got to be careful, like, if you're out shooting on the side of the road and you're using fake guns, like, you know, cops could pull up and, like, not know what's going on. You know, so we have policies as a film school of, like, what is and is not, you know, appropriate, and like how you deal with like these things in terms of safety. No, but he was posting this rant about, like, you know, because it's stupid and it's not creative. And I responded, and he called me stupid, and he blocked me on Facebook. And this is a professor at a university. and my response was basically like, look, I teach at the community college. I have kids who like, you know, sometimes they come from families where they have, you know, they come from environments of gang violence and stuff. And like, you know, I'm not going to tell them they can't write about their own life experiences. I'm not going to tell them they can't make movies about their own life experiences. Like, get out of your fucking goddamn academic bubble and like,
that's just
stop preaching, you know, and like, let people be creative. You know, if your concern is safety, that's one thing. But if your concern is like, you're going to preach your morals and like force your whatever academic convictions on students who are just here to learn and be creative and be sponges, that's not your job, you know? And he just said, this is just your horror bullshit. And he blocked me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's terrible. It's not unexpected, but it's terrible.
Yeah. It made me so angry. So when I read your thing, and again, as a writer going through writing programs, I was actually pretty lucky that I actually had some pretty great teachers, and I went through some good writing programs, and I was pretty encouraged.
Yeah,
from sort of high school forward, I had the occasional teacher who was like, "Do you really need to move?" You know, but I had the occasional like other, you know, student in my cohort, you know, who would like wag their finger at me or whatever. But I didn't have that experience of someone basically trying to pound out of me my own sensibility or my own creativity. And when, I mean, you said you quit writing for what, 25 years?
Yeah, 25, 30 years. I mean, I'm a copywriter, an advertising copywriter, you know, so I was still writing.
Sure.
Yeah. But and I was getting paid to write, but it scratched the itch, you know. It wasn't the same. But a lot of times, I'm a slow writer to begin with, and a lot of days, you know, when you're writing 8-10 hours for work, the last thing you want to do is write another. You spend another 4 or 5 hours that night writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sometimes people will say, I'd love to be able to write full time. It's like, maybe as a full time writer, but you don't want to be a writer and then a writer, if that makes sense. It's a lot of writing. But I just think over time, because you know, in advertising, like 99% of the stuff you write never sees the light of day. Yeah. Either you kill it, your creative director kills it, or the client kills it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got a much tougher skin and just. Mm-hmm.
It's like, a little bit like being a screenwriter can be kind of the same. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one day I just woke up and I had an idea for a story in my head, and I just sat down and wrote it. And this was, it sucked, but I was writing again, you know. It's like, it was like just that taking the finger out of the dike or something. And
which story was that?
That was a story that is not in here because it's not very good, but it was called oh my gosh, what was that one called?
Yeah, you mentioned
Soul Garoth. Yeah,
sorry, say it again.
Souls Are Us.
Okay.
It was about a guy who worked in the soul factory, and he was trying to figure out what to do with Jeffrey Dahmer's soul.
That's a great concept.
It was funny. I mean, I could go back and revisit it sometime. It got published, but it was, a for the love thing, and I doubt that it's even available anywhere anymore. But then Fresh was like right at that same time period. That's in the book. That one is funny because I wrote it as the main character is a demon and everyone thinks it's a vampire. So it's a vampire story. Whatever, I don't care. If people want to say it's a vampire, he's a vampire.
So let's go ahead and dive into the book here. So let's talk about that story a little bit, because that was one that I really enjoyed. So give us the setup for that story.
Well, this is one that I had written it linearly. Is that a word? Linearly. And my neighbor in Denver is also a writer, and she read it, and she's like, you need to start with the scene in the bathroom. And she's the one who had me put that at the beginning, where this germaphobe basically comes to in the bathroom, and he's like not wearing his clothes. He has no idea how he got there. And he's stuck in a roadhouse bathroom. And if, being a germaphobe, he doesn't know how to get out of the bathroom because there's no paper towel that he can grab the doorknob with. And he has to wait until a police officer comes and lets him out. Then it goes from there. Him and the police officer have hijinks ensue.
And then it ends up being, and we're gonna avoid spoilers as best we can, but very much not what you expect.
No.
And like you said, it could be involve vampires, it could involve angels, it could involve demons. There's lots of blood, and
Yes.
we can leave it at that. And
Yes. There's a
it's
lot of
definitely,
blood.
there's a lot of blood, and it's a germaphobe's nightmare.
Someone asked me after they read it if I was a germaphobe, and I'm like the opposite of a germaphobe. I'm a firm believer in the 5 second rule. If I pick it up in less than 5 seconds, it's still eatable.
So is this, so was Fresh kind of like after Souls R Us, is Fresh kind of the first story you wrote that you kind of felt more
Felt good about.
confident, like you were really finding your voice?
And then I wrote, and then I wrote a lot of shit. And then it's only been in the past, I'd say 4, maybe 5 years that I've actually gotten where I'm not, I don't want to say embarrassed, but I feel a lot better about what I'm putting out.
Where was Fresh published before the collection?
That was published. I'm trying to think. I think that was published in I want to say Suspense magazine, and maybe this other one called Cemetery Moon. Not Cemetery Dance, but Cemetery Moon. It was a teeny little tiny book that a long time ago.
I kind of remember that. I think I remember an open submission call for that, that
I think I got
I
$5
might have submitted to and did not get in, if I'm
for
remembering
it.
correctly.
It's a fun story. I'm actually proud of that one. There's a ton of ones that I'm not proud of, so but they're not in the book, so no one will see those.
Well, and that's, I mean, and that's the process, you know. And I think that's the thing that, like, these, and I'm going to go back to these, not to dwell on it, but these kind of writing workshops that I think can be more detrimental than they can be helpful. And then I want to talk about the writing workshops that it seems like were helpful to you, because I know you did the one at the Stanley. I'm really curious about that one.
Oh, yeah.
But one thing that I find with it can be a problem with my students sometimes, particularly the ones who are maybe less confident in their voices and in their work. And these are the ones where that you have to be very careful with, and that I think these writing workshops can be very just deadly for, is they want to come in, they don't really understand the concept of a first draft. And they don't understand the concept of, like, sometimes it just doesn't work. You know, sometimes you try an idea and it just dies on the page, you know, and you just got to move on to the next idea. And like I always tell my students, and this is particularly true in screenwriting, is, you know, you'll get caught up in a scene and you know like what the next scene is, but you don't quite know how to get there, and you just got to like power through to get there. And it's like, give your permission to write the shitty version of a scene, you know. Or, you know, give yourself permission to write the shitty version of a draft, you know, try it. You know, you can always like try to fix it. And sometimes you can't fix it. Sometimes the story dies, you know,
Oh,
put it
yeah.
in the bin, move on. There's always the next story. But I have students come in and it's like, if the first draft isn't perfect, you just see that emotional spiral happen.
My first drafts are terrible. A lot of my first drafts,
everybody's first drafts are terrible.
You know, because I write a lot of radio spots, is the majority of what I write. I write tons of dialogue and I'm really comfortable with dialogue. So a lot of my first drafts, I just write all the dialogue.
Interesting.
And then I just go through and start filling in all the story details and just start, you know, making it longer and adding more to the story. But a lot of times I just start writing a conversation between two characters and just see where it goes.
Yeah. What's interesting is I'm pretty comfortable with dialogue. I think from my time as a screenwriter, but as I've kind of more transitioned more to prose and kind of gotten out of screenwriting, I've almost overcorrected to like my first drafts are so description heavy that I'll almost forget. I'll write like four pages and be like, a character hasn't spoken in four pages. What am I doing?
Yeah.
And then I have to like remind myself, like have the character do something. Like it's not just like mountains being pretty or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Like I'll have like two pages worth I just like throw away. But you know, sometimes you gotta just write, you gotta write it out of your system.
Yeah, it's not where the story needs to start sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
It's yeah, I mean I wish I was better at writing longer, you know, because I think 5,700 words is the longest thing I've ever written.
Interesting.
A lot of that comes again from being in advertising, as I'm used to writing to a tight space and writing as
short,
concise as I can. And I don't know how to write longer.
I think that's part of the strength of a lot of these stories, though, is like, I think one thing you're, I'll tell you, I just posted a review for you on Amazon today, which I don't do for everything that I read, but I was inspired. And one thing I said is that you managed to go from like achingly poignant to bone chillingly scary to laugh out loud funny to like, you know, gag inducingly gross in just a few words, you know, like you've got to really, I think you're in this makes absolutely makes sense that your training is in copywriting. Would kind of give you this instinct is your ability to like get there quick without it ever feeling rushed. You know, you have a, like one of, I think, and it's one of your funnier stories, Meet Cute. And it's very short and I don't want to say much about it. It's got a great pun in the title and the story itself is almost just a great pun of a story. And it's just like the perfect length with like the best, just like button at the end. And and it's like, if it was any longer, the whole thing would have fallen apart.
Oh, you thank know. You. That's, yeah. You know, the best thing to me about that story is that was published in the first issue of Red Room magazine. I don't know if it's ever a second issue, but I was on the cover with Jack Ketchum and Tim Wagner.
Oh, wow.
My name listed under those. I was like, oh my God. So I had to send me a nice print ready file. So I one of these days I'm going to print a poster of it just to hang in my office.
That's just just to have that experience and just sharing a cover with those two.
I know, that was great.
Yeah.
that was one I read that story at the StokerCon in Portland. And I was really, really nervous, obviously, because the first line of the story is this guy is yelling internally, "Stop staring at her tits." And I'm like saying that out loud in a reading, and I'm like, all turn their head like, what's going on over here?
Well, that's an interesting because, and you've mentioned obviously, you know, Jeff Strand, and he's kind of known as the king of the horror comedy. And if you've sat through a reading with him, you know, he really commits to that.
Oh, yeah.
What is, you know, one thing I really appreciate about the collection is your ability to move from tones is really remarkable, I think, because you can go from, I'm just looking at your table of contents here, and you have the story, The Space Between, which is obviously the title story, which is very frightening and is sort of a little bit almost of, I'm going to say, and you can tell me if I'm onto something here. It feels like it's a connection or maybe almost a sequel, a spiritual sequel maybe, to the story Strange Constellations, which is earlier in the book.
There are overlaps in that story. So those, the space between Strange Constellations, the tunnel at the end of the light, and Lost at Last, the last one, all take place in the same universe.
Interesting, because I didn't necessarily put that together with the tunnel at the end of the light, but now that you say it, I can see it. But I was going to say the tunnel at the end of the light is a really interesting story, because that story, and I would say to a degree, maybe Reaching Bottom, is similar, although I'm gonna get back to Reaching Bottom, because that one really struck me in a particular way. But the tunnel at the end of the light, again, I don't want to spoil anything, this story, I know you refer to it, I think, in your introduction. This was inspired in part by your participation in a writing conference at the Stanley.
And it's every bit as awesome as you
expect. I've always wanted to do that conference, and I want to talk about that in a sec, but just real quick, that story is probably like the emotional effect on me of that story, and just in large part because I've been to the Stanley. I've never been to that writing conference or writing, what would you say?
It was he called it a writer's retreat, but it was really more just a little convention thing. A lot of authors there. It's like Jack Ketchum was there and Josh Mallerman was there, and some other big names. We just all hung out basically for the weekend.
You know? Sounds really.
I made awesome. A lot of really good friends there, and it was fantastic. Unfortunately, the guy who organized it, R.J. Cavender, turned out like to be a whole nother.
Really?
It's a whole other story. He's kind of like gone from the horror scene now. So those won't ever happen again.
Oh, that's too bad. I was hoping that would happen again, because I've always wanted to go to it.
If someone were to organize it again, but he's not going to organize it again. Okay.
sounds like there's a backstory there that maybe should be kept off of the podcast.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about it now.
Okay. But again, without going into spoilers, you know, it's obviously, it's set during this writer's retreat, but it involves grief, and it's a very particular kind of grief. And I think this isn't really a spoiler, because it's set up very early in the story. It's the main character has lost their dog, and I am a huge dog lover. Man. And I've been to the Stanley. It's set at the Stanley Hotel. I've been to the Stanley. I've stayed at the Stanley, and I've been on that exact ghost tour that is referred to. I've seen those tunnels.
Oh yeah, they're awesome.
So that one really, but that one is just, it's a scary story. It's like, I found it definitely gave me the shivers, but it also, it just really deeply, deeply affected me. And then you follow it up immediately with Necrophiliacs Anonymous, which I was cackling through. And then of course you follow that up with Meet Cute, which I was also cackling. Like, I just gave me like the biggest like belly laugh at the end. And then you follow it with Blind Spot, which was one of the scariest stories in the collection. Oh. So just the roller coaster of like
emotions. I think I had to give a palate cleanser after Tunnel. I would say 80% of that story is autobiographical. I mean, I really did lose my dog right before I went there. And that story was me processing the loss of Coco. I'd had her since she was 8 weeks old, and she lived to be almost 18.
Yeah.
And all the stuff I talk about that happened with her at the end, that was all true. But the only thing that was exaggerated in the story was I didn't do quite as many drugs.
Right.
Not quite that many, but there was a lot of drinking. It was a fun weekend, but it was a sad weekend for me too, you know.
And sure. I think
that's how but after you get through that, then I figured I want to lighten it up with Necrophiliacs Anonymous. And
which is just, I mean, it is as ridiculous as the title suggests. And it's another one where it's just the brevity really works for the story.
I read that one at Pittsburgh Stoker Con.
I missed it. I think I missed your reading, and I regret it now.
I enjoy doing readings, because I when you present ads, you have to get up and read them to people. So it's not that, but I'm much more nervous reading my personal, this kind of things than I ever was reading an ad to a client, you know. And so the first couple of times, like when I did the reading at Portland and when I did a reading at the Long Beach on the Queen Mary, I was nervous as heck. I almost, but then for some reason or other, and I found like when I get really nervous, I would take, because I have, you know, anxiety. And so I will take Xanax for it if it gets too bad. But in Pittsburgh, I didn't have any. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do? So I said, you know, I'm just going to do the opposite. I drank a shit ton of coffee. And I just went the total opposite end of the spectrum in terms of my reading. I was pacing back and forth up there and
That can
acting
work.
voices and just sticky. And I was like, I'm going to read like this from now on.
Yeah.
This is much better
Yeah.
than just
Yeah.
me hiding behind my paper and reading in a monotone delivery.
I mean, did you see, speaking of readings at Pittsburgh, did you see Clay McLeod
Oh my
Chapman's
God.
reading?
He's like a dog. And he didn't, he had it memorized.
It was the most incredible. Yeah, there was no paper in hand. It was, I mean, well, what was it? It was a
It was about
Lovecraftian adaptation of like,
elementary school thing.
it was, well, I think it was like a school sex ed class
Yes.
done in like a Lovecraft, written in like a perfect Lovecraftian pastiche
Oh
with
my
like
God.
the voice and everything and his perform. I mean, that's got to become legendary. Like,
He was.
I hope someone was recording it and that it gets posted somewhere. I don't know if anyone was.
Yeah, I don't know, but
It deserves to be on Netflix, to be honest. Like,
he was crawling over chairs and getting right up in people's faces, and it was amazing. I was like, I don't have to follow that.
I would love to get him on here just to do that, but I don't know that I could. But like that really showed me, it's like, yeah, getting up and just doing a reading is like almost not enough, you
Oh
know.
no, not after that's a whole nother level, you know.
It's
I will never hit that level, but
yeah, that's, I mean, he I don't know his background, but it's like he has to have like theater training or
yeah, he
something. Like,
does. And it definitely shows,
you're right. It was
you know,
legend. I mean, that's got to become legendary.
he was just on, I don't even remember what one of the podcasts I listened to, he was on recently and talked about his readings and his theater background and things like that. And it's like, it all makes sense, you know.
It was like nothing I'd ever seen.
No. It was fantastic. You know, the necrophiliac story when you were talking about writing courses and stuff, that was a class, that was a story that came out of a Fright Club. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, Mona Lawrence teaches it, and it is, I mean, I've taken a lot of, you know, courses. I mean, Borderlands was good, but it was a certain kind of thing you learn, you know.
I
Fright
never.
Club is the best thing I've ever taken.
Okay.
And
So
it's
talk
10
about
weeks.
that a little bit more. Yeah.
Yeah, it's 10 weeks long, and I've taken one and two, and basically every week you have to write a 2,000 word story. You know, owner gives you the topic, and you have a weekly meeting where he gives you a lot of background on the topic and stuff, and different directions you can take. And then, you know, you got to turn in 2,000 words by the end of the week, and
That
then
sounds
two
great.
people in the course will read your story, and you have to read two people's story. And he's got like a big spreadsheet, so you're always reading someone else's story.
And is this something you just do like remotely? Like,
Yeah, he actually
okay.
lives in Germany,
Oh,
so.
wow.
Yeah, so it's all remote online.
And who is it who runs it?
Mona Lawrence,
Oh, okay. Yeah.
and he it used to be run through the HWA, and now he does it on his own. But he gives the
Okay.
HWA members a really good discount.
Okay, yeah, because I've heard of it, but I didn't know much about it. And of course, I know about Borderlands. I don't know if that is gonna. I heard that it was gonna continue under a different name and different
Well,
stewardship.
last
I know
year.
that there was obviously a lot of controversy over
Yeah, I mean, well, you know,
Tom Monteleone kind of lit his legacy on fire last year,
Reaching
so.
Bottom was shortlisted for the next Borderlands anthology, and when all that shit blew up, I pulled it, and
Yeah.
that fucking killed me, man, because that was a bucket list
Well,
publication.
that's a perfect Borderlands story. I mean, that was so sad to me because you know, when I was in high school, those Borderlands anthologies were such an influence. You know, when I discovered those, I was probably 17 or 18 years old. The first two or three. I remember finding them at a Borders Books in Albuquerque.
Borders books, yeah.
Yeah. And it was just, I knew nothing about them. It was just they had that what's it? I want to say Michael McKean, but that's not his name. But the guy, that artist
Oh,
does the Sandman, did the covers for the Sandman comics.
yeah, I don't know his name. I'm terrible with names like that.
Yeah. Someone will remember and correct me. I know his last name, I believe, is McKean, but Dave McKean, I think. But he I just loved the covers. I was like, these look cool. And then I dove into those stories, and they were so weird and so different.
Yeah, and
And
it's a
I
shame.
met Tom Antillione at StokerCon 2022, and he was so nice to me when I introduced myself to him. And turns out, probably because I looked right
Yeah.
to his tastes, I guess.
Yeah. That's well, Brian and Mary had already taken over.
I hadn't realized
Paul,
that.
yeah, Paul and Tom had given it to Brian and Mary, and they did the first one at AuthorCon last year, like just a few days before AuthorCon. But I haven't heard anything about another one coming. And they got the comic book store going now, so I don't know.
Yeah. When I had heard, I think so it's Brian and Mary were going to take it over. And I heard that
Yeah.
they were going to rechristen it and kind of totally separate. And I hope they do because it sounds like it was, from what I understood from people who went to it was like Borderlands Boot Camp, I think was what it
Yeah,
was
that's
called,
what it was
right?
called.
And from what I understand, it was people either got a lot out of it or were completely kind of traumatized by the experience.
You know, it's in Baltimore, which is like 45 minutes from where I live now. And I went 1 year, then the next year a friend of mine was going to be there. A couple of friends were in that class. So I went over there to go out to dinner with them, you know. And one of my friends, she was so distraught over the way that they had treated her. She wouldn't come out of her room.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, come on, let's go out to dinner. She's like, I can't be around people. She was just so upset. And it was just sad, you
Yeah,
know.
that's and I had submitted a couple of stories to Borderlands, and I never got in, but I received, personal feedback that was very encouraging. And then I'd heard from people after the fact that, oh, they got these rejection letters that were just scorching,
Oh my God, yeah. My friend Rebecca Allred had a story in one of the Borderlands, and she had submitted two, and she got this glowing letter for the one that was re that was accepted, and the other one was awful. Just they just raked her over the coals for that story.
And I just don't see the, again, as a teacher, I don't believe in hand-holding and blowing smoke up people's ass. I think genuine, sometimes difficult criticism is important for people's growth, but you've got to find that balance. And when you get that level of just, that kind of scorched earth kind of criticism that you get in the writers' workshops that literally push people out of writing for 25 years, as it sounds like happened to you, that's more about you than it is about somebody's work. That's about your ego. That's not about what someone has presented to you.
It's not helpful, you
No,
know.
you're not
That's
helping anyone. You're showing off is what you're doing. It's
Yeah.
bullying. That's all it is. It's just bullying with like a thesaurus,
Oh.
there's no call for it. I don't see, and I didn't realize that Borderlands had that kind of reputation. And it's a bummer to me because I still have those. I think I have those three original anthologies, and I have several more on my Kindle. And it's just hard for me to look at them the same way, at this point.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine who's been in two of them, and he's like, you know, he's ugh. Yes.
Well, so you got accepted with Reaching Bottom, but you pulled it, you said.
It was shortlisted.
It was
Yeah.
shortlisted.
Yeah. And but yeah, I pulled it. I just
Well, can we talk about that story? Because that is one of the scariest stories I've ever read, I
Oh,
have to
really?
say.
That
And now that gets to like some of my particular fears. I would say drowning is a big fear of mine. It gets into some cosmic horror, gets into, you know, disease, existential kind of just fears of mortality. And again, don't want to spoil anything, but just give us a little bit of the setup of that and where that story kind of came from.
You know, that one started out as just like a 600 word piece of flash.
Interesting.
And I kept, you know, no one, I couldn't get it published anywhere. So I started working on it for one of the assignments for Fright Club and made it a little bit longer and then got some feedback on it and they just kept making it longer. Like the original version, none of the interaction with his doctor, none of that was in there. It was basically just, it opened with him in the boat on the lake, you know? And that was pretty much the twist was the entire story. It was so short. But the story itself is basically just a guy who finds out that he has terminal cancer and decides he wants to, I don't think I put a suicide trigger warning on this one. I guess I should have, because he doesn't actually commit suicide, but he wants to. He decides he wants to go back to where he had the best time of his life as a kid with his friends. And
it's also very clear from the first paragraph. So if people are like, nope, you know, you can nope out of that story. Like,
yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's not like I hide it in the middle of the story. No, right up there up front.
It's right there. No, that one, like anyone, and I, you know, I've talked about it, I think, extensively on my other podcast, The Weirdest Thing. Like, I will not go into an open body of water past my knees. I will not go into the ocean. Lakes almost freak me out more because you can't see in them because they're so full of stuff, you know, and then quarries are like the worst, you know? The idea of like a bottomless, like a sinkhole or like, you know, are just thank you.
My wife is from Bloomington, Indiana, which is where I'm, you know, what is it called, Breaking Away, where that movie was filmed. Mm-hmm. And there are tons of quarries around there, you know. Yeah. So but I hate the ocean, terrifies me. Mm-hmm. It is just so big and so vast, and I am not the top of the food chain. And I'm scared to death of tsunamis. Every time we're at the ocean, I keep waiting for a tsunami to come in, kill me. And my wife loves the ocean.
Yeah.
You know, so that's
you could not pay me to live. I mean, I've lived in California, I lived in Boston, but like as far as like looking for a place to retire, I will not, like, I'm not looking for a beach house or something like that. Like, put me up in the mountains of Colorado, like you're saying, that's where I want to be. Yeah.
I want to be out in the woods. Close enough to someplace I can get like to a Chipotle within a half an hour or something.
Right.
But I still want to be away from people.
Boulder sounds good to me.
Oh, I wish I could afford Boulder.
I know.
Boulder's a great town, the People's Republic of Boulder, as we always called it.
Yep.
But yeah, there's no way I can afford to live in Boulder.
Yeah, no.
It's unfortunate. So I can't give away the big twist on it, but it's I really like that story. It's funny. That story and Tunnel and Lost at Last are like three. I was talking on another podcast recently with Nicole Bell. It was on Killer Mediums, and we were talking about personal brands. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my early stuff was all horror comedy, you know. And I was known for. So a lot of my book has that, but it's one of those things, you know, you get. Well, want to try to write other things. And so I've noticed like a lot of the reviews I've got so far, the few I've got, they point out like, oh, I love Caterwaul about the killer gnome and stuff. I'm like, but what about my dog story? I love my dog.
I mean, I think I am someone who, it's funny because, and I'm sure Rebecca will be listening to this. You know, I think Rebecca, when Rebecca and I first got to know each other, she published a story of mine called 7 Days of Dog Walking, which is probably the closest I've come to writing a horror comedy story. And so I think she sort of almost like wanted me to be a horror comedy writer. And that's like very much an anomaly for me. and so like, you know, I tend to like gravitate, I think, more towards things like The Tunnel at the End of the Light or Reaching Bottom. Those are the stories that, you know, tend to be closer probably to my sensibility. Mm-hmm. So for me, like the horror comedy stories are like, they're these like nice treats for me because that's outside of my wheelhouse. typically. And like, I like horror comedies, and I like when I write, when I personally, when I find myself writing something that veers towards comedy, it's like I'm always like sort of pleased with myself, because it's like, oh hey, like I'm like working a muscle that I forgot I had, you know?
Because I feel that way when I don't go for the laugh. Right?
Yeah, because I tend to forget that I actually can be kind of pretty funny. Like, oh yes, I do have a sense of humor, you know, because my stories have a tendency to just to go grim. Mm-hmm. So like for me, probably my favorite of the funny stories in here is probably Trash Talk. The garbage monster.
Oh, that's another Fright Club story.
Really? Interesting.
The assignment was kaiju, and that's a great
kaiju story. Yeah.
Everyone's gonna do like a big lizard or reptile or animal monster or something. I said I'm gonna do a 90-foot sentient trash dump.
Yeah.
I think it turned out fun. It's a fun story.
It's fun. It's got a fun lead character. I like the guy just constantly getting punched in the face by the army guys. I really enjoyed just the image of when you see the two soldiers standing there wet, and the main character is like, yep, because he realizes that he was correct, that the monster's just constantly pissing trash water all over everybody. That's a good, like, that one made me laugh all the way through. But that one's got like kind of a weird dark Lovecraftian ending.
Yeah,
sort of takes a little bit of a like spooky turn at the end.
It's like funny, what? And then,
a little existential horror at the end.
Where did that come from?
Yeah. So I really just, like I said, I enjoyed the collection all the way through. I think it's like I said, you've got obviously a real facility with the short form. I do want to talk about in one story in particular, and let me see, because like I told you before, I'm terrible with titles, so I'm looking at the list.
Okay, I'm terrible with character names.
Yeah, and I forgot my reading glasses, so. Let's see, it's the out, what is it, the outpost?
Oh, the outpost outside.
The outpost outside. That story in particular struck me as, this could be the setup of a novel. And so I want to ask you, now I don't know that it is.
No, I don't have a novel.
I want to both put the bug in your ear that if you wanted to turn it into a novel, I would read it. But also, do you have a plan to like try to write a longer piece or work towards a novel?
I am working toward a novella. So okay. Taking baby steps.
Okay.
I am taking, like what I said earlier, those four stories are all connected.
Okay.
They're connected by something. Each in there, there's a trail sign, or they're on the trail, the Aris Ridge Trail. Mm-hmm. And that's a through line through all the stories. And I have outlined it. It's funny because I never outlined anything before. And I outlined this, and I was really high when I did it. And then I read it the next day. I was like, fuck, man, this makes sense. I think I could do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the connection, the Aris Ridge Trail, because now I'm remembering in the tunnel at the end of the light, there's a mention of that. He goes on the hike on the Aris Ridge Trail.
Yeah.
And that, of course, comes up in
the space between Strange Constellations, and it's also in Lost at Last. He actually hikes the Aris Ridge Trail in Lost at Last.
Okay, and that's one of the.
I actually want to the novella is going to bring back characters from all of those stories.
Ah,
and it's cool. Going to be, they just kind of, you know, at some point in the novella they meet up as they explore this and trying to get back to where they need to be. They all end up at the end of their stories. They all end up someplace different than where they started, mm-hmm. like basically a different reality of some sort.
Yeah.
And it's going to be, it's very intimidating.
Yeah.
Because that's long. You know, I mean, my collection's got 20 stories in it, and it's 56,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in novella, I only got to hit 20,000, but still, yeah. It's like four. Five of my stories, six stories, and I got to do it all in one story.
And there's definitely more and more, you know, the great thing about where we're at and as a genre and the way publishing is now is there are more and more publishers out there that are looking for novellas. That used to be like a dead end, you know, 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I remember in the 90s, like, if you weren't Stephen King, there was no reason to write novellas because you had to be that kind of name. We could put out a collection of novellas, you know, mm-hmm. you know, Four Past Midnight or something.
Yeah.
If you were a budding writer, you couldn't publish a novella.
No.
There was no way. Now there's, I mean, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, like Madness Heart Press, you know, they're putting out novellas all the time, you know.
I love novellas. I mean, I love short stories and collections mm-hmm. and anthologies are my favorite things to read.
Right.
But I think novellas are just like the perfect length for a horror story.
Yeah, for a horror story in particular, for horror fiction in particular, novellas really are, yeah, because horror... And I think your work really works on this level quite well. I always, you know, my definition of horror when I teach genre writing, you know, I apologize to listeners who have heard me say this before because this is, you know, this is me repeating myself, but I always kind of break down, you know, I say sci-fi is, you know, taking our rational world, you know, our world and taking like the laws of physics as we know them and just extrapolating beyond what we know, right? And then fantasy is taking another world and creating its own rules, you know, so you have, you know, like Westeros is a world that happens to have dragons. Yeah. Or the Harry Potter universe, you know, there's wizards or whatever, but they all still function within rules. You know, it's just rules that are different than our rules. The horror story takes a world with rules and then violates the rules. You know, it takes a rational world and then introduces irrationality. Oh, and
yeah, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, and like
the teacher,
and so like the George R. R. Martin's genius is that he manages to turn Game of Thrones or, you know, A Song of Ice and Fire into a horror story by introducing the others or the White Walkers because they violate the rules that he has set up of that world,
mm-hmm.
you know, so all of a sudden that becomes a horror story within the rules of that world. But with horror in general, it part of when you introduce that irrationality, what happens when you write long is you tend to come to this tendency of wanting to explain things in the end, you know, because
yeah.
a reader eventually like it's hard to write 1,000 pages of something and then be like, I don't know, you know, it is what it is.
Yes.
But you can do that in 5,000 words or even 20,000 words or even 50,000 words, you know, but once you get past that, it gets harder to sustain that. And that's where like the novella is a really good length for that, I think. And like, you're really great at, you know, I think about like Strange Constellations where you take the Lovecraftian thing and you boil it down into such a deceptively simple package, but there's so much potential complexity happening, but it's from the perspective of these little kids, so they don't understand anything.
Yeah.
So you don't have to explain anything, you know. It's just so much is like flying past us, you know.
I wrote that story. I had never been in a corn maze when I wrote that, and I actually mm-hmm. did that. I went to one like a couple of years after that one was published. I was like, wow, I got a lot of this shit right.
Yeah. You
know? And I'd seen videos of it, people walking right. through. My wife had, you know, growing up in Indiana, she'd been through them, and she told me about them. And I thought, okay, I can do that. And then I finally went to one, and I thought, man, this, I think I got this. You know, it makes sense. I mean, that one, and That's What Friends Are For both made the preliminary Stoker list for sure.
Oh, nice.
But I didn't move on to the final ballot for either one of them. That stinks.
But yeah.
Preliminary is still cool. It's top 10.
I mean, I keep trying to get on that preliminary list that I have. I'm like, come on, guys. You know, I keep sending the emails out.
And oh, I know. Yet. It's part of the game, man.
I know.
I always, you know, my wife
you
doesn't.
You can't take it personally.
No. She doesn't read any of my things. The only thing she's ever read of mine were ones she listened to them, two of them that were on No Sleep.
Oh, okay.
So I always make up a blurb from her for my mass emailings. I would always make up one from my mom too.
I saw that.
I'd get like one from an author and then put something in, like, you know, my, you know, well, this didn't suck, my wife, you know? And I put a blurb from my mom in the front of my collection too.
Yeah, I saw that.
it's hard because my mom, you know, she passed away at the end of last July. She didn't get to see the book. Thanks.
Yeah.
And you know, tomorrow is her birthday. It's the first one. But I mean, she knew I had the contract, and she'd read all the stories. But she was always my biggest cheerleader, you know. So it was kind of
That's
sneaky that she doesn't get to see the book, but she knows that, you know, she
well, it
knows.
has to be like, as a horror fan herself, this has to be like a had to be a treat for her to see you like on this path, you know?
Oh yeah, she was just tickled. She would tell everyone, "My son's a horror writer."
That's great.
Mom, stop.
No, that's great, because you know, a lot of times, you know, people don't have parents that are supportive that way.
Yeah, my dad wasn't at all, but my mom was.
Yeah. I mean, I always joke about my parents as being like, they don't get it, but they're like, well, okay, you know. They're like, this is what we ended up with. But they've actually, you know, the truth is they've been very supportive and very kind of generous with their weirdo son, you know. you know, I know I've talked to plenty of people where their parents, and I know, you know, particularly of artists, you know, creative people in general. And we talk about this with, you know, you get this from the people in the writing workshops trying to beat stuff out of you know, but parents can do that
Oh, yeah.
in their own way. It's just like, get a real job. You know, what are you doing this kind of thing for? Why are you wasting your time with this? You know,
I
and
don't think my
I've
dad
known
under
plenty of people like that. And
Yeah.
so, you know, I've been very grateful to have my parents who, like I said, you know, my dad's an engineer. You know, my parents both worked at the lab here, and they don't necessarily get it, but they've been very encouraging. You know, they've been very supportive. And it's great to hear that your mom was that way.
Yeah, she was very supportive. I don't think my dad I understood what I did as a copywriter. I would say, you see that commercial on the TV? I did that. And he's like, so did you direct it? Did you tell them what to do? And I said, no, I wrote it. He's, what do you mean you wrote it? I said, all the words coming out of their mouth, I wrote them. When he walks over there and does that, I wrote that. I wrote everything there. Oh, well, so you didn't direct it though. Who directed it? They made the commercial. I was like, oh, damn, you're.
It's driving you kind of crazy.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, but it hurts that mom's not here to see it, you
Yeah,
know.
no, that's that, and I'm sorry to hear that she's gone.
Well, thanks. It was very sudden, very unexpected. Just none of us. She was in the hospital for a couple of days, just and it's gone. So that was hard. But yeah, I thought, you know, I would put a nice little blurb from her. And because she, I mean,
It's a
she
tribute.
used to say that she dropped me on my head all the time. So that
Yeah.
was the blurb I wrote for her for my
That's
book.
perfect.
She would have got a kick out of that.
Well, I'm looking forward to, I hope you do continue with the novella, because that does sound great. And I do want to ask, because, you know, these three, I guess you would call them the Eris Ridge Trail stories. They clearly have a Lovecraftian influence. And then, oh, and I do want to touch on The World's End at the World's End, which also is very Lovecraftian. It's set that one up for us real quick.
I forget the publisher, but they had a call out to mash up two fairy tales, or what they wanted mashed up. And I mashed up, let me think, there is the Gingerbread Man and Rose Red and Snow White and the Well of the World's End. Those three, but then I also threw in some Lovecraft and King in Yellow in there as well. So they wrote me back and said, "Yeah, we really love this story, man, but you got too much shit going on." So.
I mean, what I loved about it is, you know, there's something in some of those fairy tales, you know, they can really touch on, you know, something that kind of bumps up against cosmic horror in a way without
Fairy tales
ever.
are scary. They're super frightening.
Well, and they always feel like they take place in a world that's just not ours, you
Yeah,
know?
it's just like adjacent to ours, you know.
So it could be Carcosa.
Yeah.
You know, like you've crossed over through some sort of thin where it's like the stars aren't quite ours, to quote
Yeah,
your
those aren't
stories.
my.
And so the way you combined those Lovecraftian elements and the King in Yellow in that story, I just thought was brilliant. And it's another one that's like funny, but not. It's actually like kind of made me a little squirmy, like the bear is ripping off its own face, and I will unmask you. And I was like, this is bringing out, it's like hitting some lizard brain little kid kind of itchy spot,
Yeah, all the all the funny in that one is in the dialogue. There's a lot of funny back and forth between the characters, but the
yeah,
story
there.
itself is not funny.
Right. But I did want to ask, I'm fascinated by people's relationship with Lovecraft and cosmic horror, because I'm sort of fascinated by where people stand with like finding, I talked to Gwendolyn Kleist and we talked about the movie Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Oh, I just listened to this one. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's right.
And and I'm a Lovecraft fan, but of course, as we all know, Lovecraft is,
An asshole.
yeah, he's got his own
Yeah.
history that we all have to wrestle with. And so I'm always like sort of happy to find cosmic horror that either escapes Lovecraft in a way, which is what I would say Picnic at Hanging Rock kind of does, or that takes Lovecraft and like strips a lot of the like Lovecraft out of Lovecraft. Or like, or like finds a new way to approach Lovecraft, which is what I think you do. The most overtly Lovecraftian thing you have here, of course, is The World's End at the World's End, because you are overtly referencing Lovecraft,
Yeah. Yeah,
because that's kind of it needs that. That's the joke of the story. But with your Ayers Ridge Trails stories, you're getting at that cosmic horror thing in your own way, in a way that feels very, I can feel the Lovecraft influence, but it feels like your voice is your own. So, how much Lovecraft do you feel like is in there, and how much are you kind of pulling from other sources, and how much are you trying to like kind of make it your own?
I, this won't sound good as a horror writer, but the only Lovecraft I have ever read is At the Mountains of Madness.
Interesting.
That's it, which is a great story. I mean, it's phenomenal. I wish Guillermo del Toro could have got his version of it. There's a couple little special effects testing that you can find on YouTube that he did that is just
Yeah,
insane.
I mean, that's a dream movie for me to see.
Oh
I hope
man.
it gets made someday, but
But
not holding
that's
my
all.
breath.
That's all of that's really all of Lovecraft I've read. And it's only been in the past couple of years that I've read The King in Yellow. I didn't
Which I
get.
think is better than Lovecraft, to be honest.
Yeah,
Like, I think
definitely.
Chambers is a better, I mean, he's clearly a better writer than Lovecraft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did not really start, man, I didn't really start really getting interested in cosmic. I mean, I knew about it and but it wasn't until the movie we were going to talk about that I saw The Endless
Yeah.
that really got me into non-Lovecraftian cosmic horror. But that's where my focus is always there, because I like cosmic horror and just the vast indifference of the universe to us puny little teeny ants. That stuff is really, really fascinating. But I just couldn't get into Lovecraft's writing style. It was
It's
too much.
it. I do like love. I have to be in the mood, and I certainly have, like, every time I read Lovecraft, I even the stuff that's like we've all agreed is like, well, this is the okay Lovecraft where he doesn't get weird in the wrong way. I still feel like I have to take a shower afterwards, but man, yeah, you really, it's, I mean, this is why the Clay MacLeod Chapman reading was so good, is he just parodied the self-importance of the language so perfectly.
Oh yeah, it was spot on, man. It
It's
was it was
spot on.
that was so I'm so glad I got to see that one.
Yeah.
And
And I
so glad
think,
I didn't read with him. They said,
yeah,
okay, there
I
is
can't
next.
even remember who read with him. And it's not like I think their readings were fine, but it's just like, how do you follow that,
Yeah, there's no way.
But I think
If
a lot of
I ever had to read with Clay, I'm definitely going first. I'm not
right.
following that.
Right. But yeah, I think a lot of the best Lovecraftian fiction I've read is actually other writers who have kind of like taken the Lovecraft's mythos and have kind of built on it rather than his stuff himself. And so it's like the children of Lovecraft and kind of the offshoots of Lovecraft, I think, are often more interesting than Lovecraft himself. And I think that's, and so this is kind of a good segue to talk about The Endless, which is the movie that you recommended.
My favorite movies of all time.
It's great. And I watched it again, and I feel a little bad whenever I think about Aaron Benson, Benson and Moorhead. And I forget who's
Justin Benson and
Aaron Moorhead. Yes. Because I've only seen two of their films. I've seen Spring, which I love. I was just texting with Rebecca again today, and we both agreed that it's basically a perfect love story. And then The Endless. And I know that they have an earlier film, I think it's called Resolution, which The Endless is like tied to. And I have
The Endless is a sequel to Resolution, but it works so much better to watch The Endless first.
Interesting. Okay.
Go back. Because I mean, the Resolution was their first film, you know, and they weren't quite nailed it.
Yeah.
So you watch the Endless, and then it fills in a lot of holes that were missing from Resolution. So you can go, now I get what that scene, and I know who that character is, and I know what they're doing. This all makes sense. And yeah. I saw that movie in Omaha at the Alamo Draft House. It was only there for a weekend, and I was one of three people in the theater.
Oh.
And I walked out of that movie, and I was just fucking, I'm sorry. Can I cuss on here? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I cuss all the time.
I was doing actually pretty good. I don't think I'd cussed up until that.
No, you caught yourself a couple times.
And I was just fucking gobsmacked. My head was just like in a daze for a couple days.
The Endless?
Watching that. Yes.
Yeah.
That is what set me on to like my fascination now with time loops and cosmic horror and alternate realities. And that's you don't want to say like a movie changed your life, but that changed a lot of where my writing focus was. Because I wasn't writing things like that like I am now before I saw The Endless.
So we should set up a little bit about what it's a hard plot to describe. Do you want to just give kind of the setup for the movie?
Yeah, if people haven't seen it. It's two brothers, Aaron and Justin. They don't play themselves, but they use their own name, who 10 years ago escaped a UFO death cult.
Mm-hmm.
And they get a videotape in the mail from one of the members saying goodbye to them. Mm-hmm. And they decide on the day or a couple of days before the death cult is supposed to commit suicide to go back and visit and say goodbye to them.
Yeah,
and that's the setup, and can't say anything more about what happened.
Right,
other than there's a great character named Shitty Carl who just walks around being shitty all the time.
Right,
he's the best. I love Shitty Carl.
Yeah, and it's very what I love about The Endless, and I feel like I can see its influence on sort of your Eris Ridge stories is that there's an element of it that's kind of a hangout movie, It's very indie. You can tell like it's very low budget. And this is their kind of aesthetic, at least through the two movies that I've seen of theirs. And they've been like, I've read some of the critics have kind of derisively kind of lumped them in with like mumblecore, but as horror guys. Yeah. And like, mumblecore. I think I kind of hate that, but I understand in the sense that they're focusing on, like, it's not heightened horror in the sense of, like, you know, there's not jump scares.
No, there's nothing like, there's no killers or jump scares or blood or murder.
Yeah, you're kind of hanging out with, like, real people who are, like, having conversations, and they're just sort of regular. And then, like, it just kind of wanders into being weird.
Yeah, the weirdness just creeps in when you're not really paying attention, and all of a sudden you're like, "Wait, what? What just happened there? And where did that come from?"
And it's like, okay, you know, they're a UFO death cult, but it's sort of like, well, we're kind of just hanging out with these cult members, and maybe they're okay. Like, maybe they're not that creepy. And then like, okay, well, maybe that was like sort of a supernatural thing, but maybe not. And then like, no, now we're in like, okay, now it's getting weird. And then all of a sudden it's weird. And then it's weirder. And then it's, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
And then no, seriously, what the fuck is going on? And then it's just this accumulation. Yeah.
Oh my God. As much as I love this movie, the only quibble I have with it is the ending is too happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could kind of see that.
I really think that they are. Can we talk spoilers about the movie?
I usually try to avoid it, just okay. because some, particularly for like movies that are a little obscure. Sometimes people haven't seen them, and I would like people to go see them. So,
because I have a total way that I would just rewrite the ending. So if Aaron and Justin ever hear this, give me a call. we'll get to work on that on your next piece. But I love everything about the movie. It's amazing to me that they're not actors. I mean, they're the director and the writer, and they just do such a good job.
And that's
basically playing themselves.
I think that's where they've gotten kind of slapped with the mumblecore thing too, because like with a movie like this, and Spring has a bit of this too, is like they go for a very naturalistic vibe. The performances are very naturalistic. It's very, they almost feel improv, even though I don't think they are. I think they're actually quite designed and quite written.
They rehearse a lot. I've watched some of the extras on the DVD, and they do just days of rehearsal, just their back and forth conversation until it's natural.
Yeah, the filmmaker in me who has watched some like legit mumblecore movies that to me are like, okay, this is a mess. Like you can tell it's like you're just wandering through a scene and you don't know where it's going. And then someone's like editing something together at the end that kind of looks like maybe they kind of stitched something together that maybe feels like it sort of went somewhere. And it's about, it's just like mopey people moping about relationships, and like they just mope to sort of an ending. Like that's not what these guys are doing. Like what they are doing is they are capturing a sense of naturalism that is, they're doing something that feels much more akin to almost like what like Sidney Lumet would do as a filmmaker, where he would work his actors to a point that like if you watch a movie like Dog Day Afternoon, you forget you're watching performances.
Oh yeah,
because he's rehearsing his actors to a point that like they're just inhabiting these roles, and the script is just like in their bones. That's not like or like Scorsese at his best would do this in a movie like Raging Bull, where it's like if there's any improvisation, it all came in the rehearsal process and through the discovery of rehearsals. And then it's like worked in a way that is makes sense narratively. It's not just like we're bumbling through a thing in front of cameras until we sort of discover a thing that kind of looks like a movie. That is clearly not what's happening in the
Endless. Have you seen the movie Coherence?
No, I have not. I keep hearing I need to watch
that. That one I read an interview with I think it was the director. It's basically that movie is almost all improv. Mm-hmm. They gave the actors, and it's all just shot in one house. Mm-hmm. And they just gave the actors, okay, here's what this scene is, go. Mm-hmm. The whole movie is this once in a lifetime comet goes overhead. And as the comet goes overhead, reality splits off into many branches. And they're interacting with versions of themselves from the different branches, and it gets violent, because
sounds interesting.
It's a really good movie, and it's shot on no money at all. And it's like I said, it's almost all improv, and it's really, really good. Well,
you can do that if you have a clear enough idea of what you want and you have really good actors. I think like the Blair Witch Project mostly works, parts of it don't, but mostly I think the Blair Witch Project works because the actors are actually quite good in that. Josh Leonard has gone on to be a really like well-respected actor, in independent films.
The girl, I forget her name, but she was the main character in the movie. I knew some people who worked at Young and Larimore, an ad agency in Indianapolis. And back then, that time, they were the ad agency for Steak and Shake. Mm. This Midwest chain, like burgers and shakes and stuff. Yeah. And one of them told me that when they were talking to her, she auditioned for the role in the Shake and Steak commercials. And they're like, well, have you been in any movies? She goes, I was in some indie thing. It's probably not going to go anywhere. You've never heard of it. And then like a couple months later,
the Blair Witch
blew up, and she's in Steak and Shake commercials.
Yeah. Well, and I think it actually really damaged her career because unfortunately, like the industry is not kind to women sometimes. I think she got so like tarred with like that one scene of her crying into the camera that she was never able to escape that. But she's actually, I think, very good in the film.
It takes me several hours to watch that because of vertigo.
Yeah, it's
I can't do found
well,
footage
it's
and
almost,
none of
yeah,
this.
in that movie in particular, because they actually operate the camera themselves, it almost works like an avant-garde film, where like half the time they're filming their feet and they're like, what am I looking at?
Yeah. When we
But
saw that in the theater, I would have to shut my eyes and my wife would hit me. I think something scary is going to happen that I
yeah.
would watch and try not to throw up.
Right.
They filmed that not far from here, like maybe, half an hour, 45
That's
minutes up the
right. Yeah,
road.
because you're yeah, that's right. You are kind of in
But
that
they
neighborhood.
have a big festival there every summer now. So I'm going to try to go to it this summer. I mean,
Interesting. Interesting.
I
Well, I'll
obviously
have to
didn't
check
buy
out
it.
Coherence because I have heard good things about it, but
It's really good. And now that you've watched, now that you've watched The Endless, go back and watch Resolution. And it's
yeah.
Resolution really plays into you can't tell us, you can't say anything without the spoilers.
I know. And The Endless is hard to talk about without spoilers too, because it goes to places that are kind of hard, very hard to describe. And the emotional place I think The Endless takes you, because it's I found it frightening, but again, not in a way that's typical to horror movies.
Yeah, it wasn't
You know?
scary. It was very unsettling.
It's unsettling, and it's a movie that sticks to you. You know, like, because I watched it, I don't know, 2, 3 years. I think I watched it during the pandemic, and that was a weird time to watch a movie like that, because everything felt unreal during the pandemic.
Yeah, no
And
kidding.
so like it messed with my head for like several days. And then I just rewatched it again last night, and it's been kind of like sticking to me all day today.
I watched it again
Again.
Saturday night. I hadn't seen it in a little while. So I'm going to go watch The Endless again. You want to go? She goes, nah, I've
Yeah.
seen it. We don't watch a lot of the same movies, but there are some we do. But
Yeah.
that's why I've got the TV downstairs, and I just go down and watch my movies.
Yeah.
We watch her movies upstairs together, and she goes to bed early, and
Go
I
watch your
do
weird
my
things.
stuff.
Yeah.
Yes,
So
but that is.
you first saw it at the Alamo Draft House, you said? Yeah.
And it was like I said, I was only one of three people in the theater, and I just, it's one of those movies that I just can't believe it's not bigger. Most people say, oh yeah, I've heard of it, but I have so many of my friends who have never seen it, and I just try to tell, just how amazing and just mind-altering it is.
I
And
feel like Benson and Moorhead in general, they've kind of become filmmakers where everyone in the genre knows their names and is kind of knows them by reputation, but still not a lot of people are watching their stuff. And like I said, I've got to admit, I've still only seen two of their films, and I looked them up on Wikipedia and I didn't realize they have several more films after
yeah,
The Endless that I have not watched.
I've seen all those. They did. They directed a few episodes of Moon Knight for
Which I haven't
Marvel,
watched, the
and
Marvel
they
show.
did a few episodes of this one really cool show. It was called like
Was the Netflix show. What was it?
it was yeah, it was like Archive
Archive
82.
81.
That's
Archive
it.
81.
Yeah,
Yeah.
they did a few episodes of that that were good, and now they did they produced all of season two of Loki. Also, which is totally their wheelhouse with the
Interesting. With the
time
multiverse and
variant authority.
yeah.
Yeah. So
Yeah, I did enjoy Archive 81, I thought. And
I
unfortunately,
can't, I
I
was
guess
so
only,
bummed it got canceled.
yeah, I was really hoping they would continue that.
Because
Yeah.
that final scene, and you're like, why? It's like, oh, yeah, we
Yeah.
canceled it. I said, fucking Netflix, man. They do
Yeah,
that to
I
all the
know.
good shows. I
Well,
was.
I think that one, no, nobody except for us weirdos watched that one, I think. I just think it did not do very well, from what
No.
I understand.
The same thing with 1899, which was the follow-up to the guys who did Dark, which is
Oh,
like
right.
probably the best time travel show in the history of time travel shows. If you do watch it, it's German, but watch it in German and read the subtitles, because the dub is just, all dubs are terrible. This one is
Yeah.
especially terrible.
That's the reason why I haven't watched Dark yet, is when they first released it, they only had a dub. They didn't have it in subtitles yet. And
Dark is
so I
so.
haven't gone back to watch it because
And it is one of the rare time travel stories that actually nails the ending. That,
I do
like, you're
have.
like, this, fuck yeah, they got it.
Can I just say real quick, and then we can close things out. You have, I think, it comes right before Reaching Bottom. You have a story, loop de loop de loop, that I think is the most perfect time travel story ever written.
Oh,
And I don't want to say any more about it.
it's a drabble. You know, it's exactly 100 words, and
Yeah.
that was in a time travel drabble book, you
Yeah,
know.
and it is perfect. It is
Well,
the perfect time travel story.
I love time travel stories. You know,
Yeah.
time travel and time loops and all those things like that are just mind twisty. I'm
Yeah.
so excited. Have you ever read Dark Matter by I think it's Blake Crouch wrote it.
No, I've read his of course I've read the
A
what
Wayward
are
Pine.
the super po oops, sorry. The super popular series,
Wayward
the
Pines, I think it
Wayward
was.
Pines. I have not
Yeah.
read Dark Matter yet.
They're making a show of it for Apple is making it.
Oh, really? I
And
hadn't
I am
heard that.
so excited because that's definitely a multiverse
Okay.
story. It's a love story.
I am definitely fascinated by multiverse stuff. I got a little bit kind of over what would the word be? Oversaturated with it with some of the Marvel stuff, which is why I haven't
Yeah.
watched Loki.
Loki's
But
good. Loki's really good.
I heard it got better. I got a little, I think, turned off by the first season. I just watched maybe half of it. And then I heard it kind of picked up. So I need to
Yeah,
go
it picked up
back
a
and.
lot in the first season. The second season is just boom, 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 you
Yeah. Well,
know.
I didn't realize the Benson and Moorhead were involved. So I'm going to have to give it a shot now.
It's definitely, it's
And
definitely.
I'll definitely read Dark Matter because that has been on my list. And I loved Wayward Pines. I know that that one has its detractors. I know that there are people who do not like the twist of that story, but I really, really dig it. I remember I listened to that as an audiobook with my ex-girlfriend while driving out to California for a wedding. And when we got to the end of, I guess the first book is Wayward. When we got to the end and you discover what's going on, and she had read it before, so she knew it was coming. I like turned to her. I was just like, "What the fuck, really?" And she was like laughing her ass off.
Have you
Yeah.
watched From the show From yet?
No, I'm like two episodes into it. That's one I need
Oh,
to.
I
Yeah,
love that show so
I really dig that one. That's one I'm like slowly working my way through. Yeah.
That's one of the. I mean, the whole show is a big what the fuck anyway. But the last episode of the first season, it's really like what the my
Well,
friend
then.
Tom Beatty said it just totally went off the rails and he won't watch it anymore. But I
Oh.
just like totally up the ante so much. It's such a good show.
Interesting. Interesting.
And
Well, I
it's the
was
guys
hooked
who made
by the.
Lost, you know, did it so.
Yeah. Well, and I'm a sucker for like the small town that like traps you kind of stories. So,
Oh, this is the very definition of a small
yeah.
town that traps you. And there are
Yeah.
monsters that
Yeah.
will eat your face.
Well, the scene from the first episode of the grandma out the window. I was hooked by that. Yeah.
Yes, me too. I was like, okay, I'm in. Whatever's going on here,
Yep.
you got me.
Yeah. All right. Well, great. Well, this was great.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for having me on, and thanks so much for all
Well,
the kind words
thanks for
about my
coming.
book.
Yeah. And yeah, so it's The Space Between. It's out now. You can read it now.
Yep.
It really is, I think, a fantastic collection. I had so much fun reading it. You have such a just a great, clear, readable voice. Like I said, it runs the gamut of tones in just the best way. It's funny, it's scary, it does have it's poignant when it needs to be poignant. It's just solid across the board. I've got three stories left. I'm looking forward to finishing it up tonight.
Oh,
Sounds like the
awesome.
last story is the last of the Ayers Ridge Trail story, so I'm looking forward to that
It's
one.
that one's about my dog Sammy. So there's another
Another
dog in that
dog
one
story.
too.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that.
I will I'll have it. I'm going to AuthorCon in a couple of weeks. So I got a table, my first table ever. So I will have
Oh,
copies
great.
of it there. And I signed up for the mass signing at SokerCon. I haven't heard if I'm gonna be there yet or not, but I will. If
Okay.
I get a table for the mass signing, the big ice cream thing, I'll have copies of it there too if people want to come out and say hi and
Awesome.
have me be
Cool.
really shy.
Yeah, like I've been telling people I'm hoping to make it to StokerCon. There's maybe some things that are gonna interrupt my plans, but I'm fingers crossed I'm gonna make it out there. So
That's a doable drive for you.
yeah, it's a doable drive. If there's if the stars align,
Yes.
If Relea rises from the depths, I will be at StokerCon this year. So hopefully I'll see
Walk
you there.
Out one night, be like, the stars are right.
I'm yes. going yeah.
Awesome, man. If I don't see you there, I'll see you somewhere.
Yeah, hopefully. So, well, have a good night, and we'll
thank you.
Hopefully talk soon. All right, well, there you have it. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much, Larry, for coming on to the show. Don't forget to check out Nighttime Logic this March 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Daniel's going to have Gwendolyn Keist on to talk about The Haunting of Velkwood. Don't forget to go ahead and go to whatever streaming platform you're using. Leave 5 stars, leave a review, go to social media, tell your friends, spread the word, and I'll be back with you guys again in a couple of weeks.